Yep, yep. So let's continue with the Inscriptorium.
Okay. He says, Andrew writes, but reviews and critical essays are where Marsh McLuhan started. Eugene McNamara edited together a collection titled The Interior Landscape, the Literary Criticism of Marsh McLuhan, 43-62, McGraw-Hill, 1969. Before we go into that, I'm thinking that Marshall was political in his criticism in the Manitoban. You know, he was not just being a literary critic. He was, as Scott would say, transdisciplinarian. He's already ready to be prime minister, you know, when he's writing for the Manitoban. He has an ostensible interest in literature. But there is that ambitious self that Don Thiel noticed in the early 50s. He was interested in power and using his knowledge to not just be a critic. And that awareness you can trace back to the 30s.
Yeah, but then again, like at least in my limited understanding of literary criticism of the period, there was definitely an understanding that poetic exegesis terminates in judgment, that the whole reason that people studied the classics, which was usurped by, English, was that it trained perception, it trained your capacity to evaluate and finally judge. And, you know, it's implied that that capacity to judge would be transposed into other spheres and domains.
Yeah.
He's the key holder of the values of society.
That's right. And he is, what you're saying is for students, for people conditioned by literacy that come to his classes, their guide to perception is the great books or the books that he points out and the way he shows them to look at it. But he's really involved in media landscapes and how to perceive them that the students aren't ready to see. They have to, you know, you're doing undergraduate perceptual work by looking at literature and whatever you get from that, the figure ground. But he's not interested in literature as an anti-environment by the 60s, as Peter Montgomery points out. He's looking at the new media environments.
Yeah, it's just a bridge. And as soon as you've done the bridge, you burn the bridge and over you go.
Yes, but no, it's a bridge he keeps for students even into the 70s.
Okay, fair enough, sorry.
That's the, quote, hypocrisy when he says, I've been accused of, hating books or being anti-book when I'm a professor of literature. He does not point out that he's a professor of literature Monday, Wednesday, Friday for young people, and they need that early phase of media dynamics. Like he says in that interview in CBC with the students, the students are vegetables. It takes a long time for them to grow into some kind of self or media awareness, and it's even questionable that they ever got to it. That is not what he's addressing when he writes his books or engages in dialogues on talk shows and that. He's not addressing books as a training of perception. He's looking at media dynamics as a training of perception. And by the 70s, he's saying media are art forms. The media themselves are almost like cyborgian art forms for other dynamics of machinic life.
Yeah, I guess that's that. That his big discoveries in the late 40s, where he discovers what the American can't get into literature unless you come at it as a technological development, and if you're a European, you can't come at technology unless you see it as a literary development. And so he's got both sides covered in that respect.
Yeah, and he definitely's got Lewis. I mean, Lewis is wrestling with the same issues as a painter, and. So he's got Lewis, and you found the letters in the late 40s where he's wondering whether to admit he's interested in Lewis. But Innes got him out of that problem. Innes was something, if you grant that McLuhan had media awareness by the middle 40s, and 46, 47, it was Innes who becomes the useful fool for McLuhan to bring in, to look like he got, to pretend he made a discovery.
Yeah, and Innes is a closet Lewisite anyway.
Yeah, so that's right. Innes is the acceptable Lewisite. So the Lewis game, it's interesting. Innes is a new environment who pushes the boundaries, but McLuhan is fitting him back into his political agenda that he already established, you know, years earlier, modeled on Lewis being the enemy. So you have a new environment, Innes, that he can stimulate people because he sees the relevance of Innes's later work. But for his own personal strategies, it's a retrieve of Lewis. It's retrieving Lewis as a new archetype. It's like the automobile is the knight in shining armor. Innes is Lewis retrieved, but it doesn't, you know, the automobile doesn't look like a knight in shining armor. Innes doesn't look like Lewis, but he is the retrieval of Lewis. The cliche of Lewis as a new archetype. You see? So he's got that agenda that he already was using with Lewis to guide him in his tactics. Okay, in his strategy. But the tactic is to make a big deal out of Innes as some amazing eureka that humans should be amazed at.
Yep. So let's press forward, because I think we can cross over into this territory again. We're talking about Andrew McLuhan recognizing that Cambridge was a shock to McLuhan.
Right. So he quotes McNamara in his preface to Interior Landscape. And, you know, McNamara does write, you know, knowing introductions to McLuhan. He seems to have a handle on he understands how the essays lead to understanding media.
Yeah, they're good. You know, I think he does a great job.
Yeah. Okay, McNamara writes, quote, obviously literature has mattered to Professor McLuhan. Now, this is being said in 969 when McLuhan looks like he's anti-book. No objective survey of McLuhan's writings over the past 30 years could deny that. But his probes of the new media have unfortunately drawn to him the very forces he excoriated in The Mechanical Bride. In the pop mind, he has become the archetype of the post-Gutenberg critic, a pop philosopher or media prophet. This present selection, one hopes, will be a step toward the rectification of a crude cartoon and a reestablishment of a truer picture of Marshall McLuhan as a distinguished and perceptive literary critic. Now, that's the P.O.B. McNamara hoping there's still value in books and literary criticism. You know, Marshall was the had no problem being the post-Gutenberg critic, the pop philosopher, media prophet, because he was on his way to tackling the Antichrist and being a new kind of comprehensive electric engineer.
Yeah, the grammarian white magic versus black magic in that sense, yeah.
Right. The issues, discovering, and Don Thiel would go into this, that Marshall, he would project that Marshall was quite upset at what happened to his image, and that cliched archetype and interior landscape were Marshall trying to get back to the 40s. I don't think so. I don't think Marshall trying to get back to the 40s, but he let other people point out his literary criticism because it diffused some of the charges against him. But McLuhan did not find the charges against him a problem on his deepest thinking. He just was trying to get into the movies, to get to whatever media profile he could get to have some kind of influence. And I think that that was a probe. He didn't have to be successful. He would not be unhappy if he didn't get to run the United Nations, but it was a potential breakthrough an opportunity that he was open to aggrandize if it worked.
Yeah, it's...
Look at this way, quoting Ulysses, every move was his next. He quoted that in the 40s and 50s, quoting Joyce. And McLuhan was operating as if every move, he had a whole range of moves, depending on the audience reception or the established reception to what he was doing.
Yeah, I've thought quite a lot about like the tone or the feeling, what McLuhan may have felt. I've tried to keep it out of everything that I've ever written about McLuhan, but it's really difficult to articulate, I think, that, well, for me at least, what McLuhan felt or sensed in front of these things. Like, I've often thought that Eliot's phrase that we do not fight for the, you know, with the hope of success, but for the chance to pass the baton on to the next generation.
That's in the Gutenberg artwork. McLuhan could do that on Wednesdays, carry on the baton, but he was not limiting himself to that world. And this is spelled out in the Southern Quality, where he says artistic egos are greatly threatened by the effect of the bomb environment. And he talks about the lost causes of T.S. Eliot and even the Southern cause, even though he says the Southern cause, which Eliot was part of in American culture, was looking like a reasonable cause among all the loser causes. It had the most resonance with the bomb environment.
But no, I'm suggesting that Eliot, out of all the four, has got that real that sense of forlorn cause, if anybody's got a sense of forlorn cause.
Oh, yeah, he understands the forlorn cause, but John Facchetti writes that book in 77 that the twilight of Anglo-American or Anglo-criticism.
That was interesting.
Yeah, but see, that's the subtext for the subculture of literacy. McLuhan talked about the literate world as a subculture. He said the subculture of literacy was trying to absorb the blacks into the subculture of literacy by giving them rights to education and voting. And Marshall said the blacks by the 60s were irritated or pissed off at being absorbed into a subculture of literacy when they already had the charisma for the electronic, larger macro culture of electronic media.
Yeah, I mean, black jazz, I think McLuhan calls the second international language after photography.
Yeah. He is, and this is what Thiel used to talk about, in the late 40s, early 50s, he's putting down R&B as thumb-sucking. That's an interesting point, is that there is some change in McLuhan that he would point out by saying, I hated cities and I hated the modern world, and the Mechanical Bride expressed that bias. And he says that I changed after Mechanical Bride. And, yes, he was anticipating his art and, you know, half a decade ahead of what he was admitting he was doing. But on top of that, and this is what Bruce Scott Taylor's pointing out, McLuhan, for someone like Scott around him a lot, had an open mind. He changed. And that's another part of exploration we're not noticing. He was probably could anticipate and have a formula for his books. But in the larger media, macro culture of electric media, the Marconi Galaxy, he was learning on the spot and changing. So only in the late 60s, early 70s would he state that jazz was an Esperanto. He would not make that kind of statement in the late 40s.
No, because late 40s he wasn't in a sense looking, and it wasn't in his political agenda.
And people have changed so much since the 40s and 50s. By the time you get 60s, 70s, McLuhan was changed like everybody else. And that's what Don Thiel says, that McLuhan was a barometer of the crises and changes that people went through.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think last session we talked about the pound era. Isn't it Don that essentially made the charge that it? No, that's Kenner was all wrong. It should have been called the McLuhan era.
No, Thiel is saying that the pound era, the teens and 20s, should be called the Joyce era. Are you talking about something else?
Yeah, who talks about the McLuhan era? Because that's the later stuff where he starts talking about where he's organizing his prehistory of digiculture around the image of the World Fair.
Okay, so yeah, no, Don Thiel is saying that McLuhan was the ground for so much more than people realize.
Yeah.
So it was the McLuhan era, not the McLuhan flash in the pan, not McLuhan as hijacked by Madison Avenue. McLuhan was a success.
Yeah, in the sense of a barometer of the whole second half of the 20th century.
Yeah. So all this analysis of McLuhan himself, which Andrew McLuhan is drawing us into, is missing the point, the larger point that analyzing McLuhan's personal motives, his religious values, is irrelevant to the dynamic that he was looking at in the 1670s. There was no people in the dynamic. He was dealing with cyborgs, fused the man with the machine. Marshall was a machine. That, you know what I mean? We're being drawn into figuring out what Marshall was about by Andrew personalizing Marshall and looking at his jottings. McLuhan was dealing with vaster environments, and that is why he didn't talk about his Catholicism. He says, my puny gestures in the hot and cool interview with Gerald Stern, my puny gestures, you know, these books are puny gestures. Just talking about the environment and making patterns about them in his interviews on the media or whatever were way more important than his books, because he was involved with programming the environment at that moment. You have that great CBC interview where he's sitting in the round, the theater in the round, and the Canadian people are taking pot shots at him. And he says, anybody would take my work. I hope I'm not taken seriously. Those kind of things were radical for an intellectual even to be or say. And he was doing art. He was doing a happening right there.
Yeah, I mean, and that totally becomes really apparent when you start looking at that book, like Lane and Trialgo's Therapy of the Word. And
yes, he was doing the therapy of pattern recognition.
Right.
Get on the media.
Magic and, words.
Yeah, and people would not understand what he's saying, but it would give a confidence that somebody out there knew what was going on. That's all the people wanted. Somebody up there in expert land's got to know. And McLuhan fulfilled that role. It really was not the content. How would you say this? If the books, the fact there were books was more important than anything the books wrote or said, well, the fact there was a McLuhan who was, quoting McLuhan, pretending to understand, pretending to know, was way more important than anything McLuhan said.
Yeah, I would request a more sober expression of that, Bob. I think that can probably be broken into. Maybe Scott, somebody you can talk to that. Essentially, I agree with you, but like we could probably break that down and geek out on that for quite some time.
Right. No, that's never been said before, and it explained. McLuhan was a useful environment in the late 60s. By the 70s. The Android meme was taken over, and the death of the public intellectual is one of the phrases in the 80s. McLuhan's role was over, you know, as a person being authority. That was in the difficult transition phase of 65 to 70, where there was a war in the Middle East. Buttons could be pressed. You know, it was a critical time, and he caused a distraction on the sidelines. His, as one of Eric's students, I forget his name, might have been Dean Motter or Dean Motter's friend, said to me in the late 70s, says Marshall became part of the ground in the 70s. And the role of McLuhan as a figure, a logocentric figure, balancing the old literate generations of World War II and that, to deal with the crisis of the baby boomer and TV effect, that role was gone by the early 70s. Marshall, he continued probing what was going on and being important, but it could not be expressed by a public intellectual. The tribal dance had totally taken over.
No, I mean, he was too old, too ugly, too white male.
And logocentric. We'd gone fully postmodern, the way the Baudrillard and Derrida talk about it. The logocentric was no longer necessary. The point is that what they don't know is McLuhan made the shift to the post-logocentric himself. You know, he was postmodern and kept up with the changes. I mean, there he is talking about Carlos Castaneda in the 70s. Whatever was happening, he had a pattern. And that, and if you think that he's being a despondent conservative Catholic, you're missing the point. And Scott Taylor gives us evidence that that is not the McLuhan. He does say that McLuhan today was disturbed by what was happening, and he should be, because the whole role of speaking was gone.
You know, I quite like Scott Taylor's treatment of postmodern, where he does he use Toynbee as the date which he props up as the end of the modern, which is essentially the end of the 1800s or something like that. So he effectively
says Toynbee. Toynbee?
I think it's Toynbee.
Toynbee wrote in the World War II 40s and 50s.
In that case, it's it might be Toynbee's analysis, where Toynbee diagnoses the end of the modern period in sort of 1850 or something like that. I'm not entirely sure that it's him. I can probably check and follow that up. But it's one of those big, you know, significant historians of the, you know, of the entire history of whatever. And so I think Taylor makes the point that McLuhan starts as a postmodern in that.
Oh, yeah, that, I agree. And so does Glenn Mott. I think that's his name, Glenn Mott.
Yeah, so by the time we're talking about McLuhan in the 70s, he's well out of the sphere of the postmodern. He's
that's right. He's paramodern. He's paramodern in the 70s.
For the second time around, perhaps, even.
Yeah, postmodern is 50s McLuhan, maybe early 60s, mid-60s. But, yeah, McLuhan, that's where Thiel's criticism is correct. It's para-McLuhan, paramodern is what McLuhan's doing. Like I say, he's quadrophenia. He's dealing with massive environments. And you know, people say, well, he didn't write any books in the 70s. Well, there's no need for them. It actually was silly to write books, and Norman Mailer found that out.
Well, I mean, it was kind of useful to have a big, heavy piece of paper that got you into the other mediums.
Well, no, he did it. And he got into the other media in the 70s, was ready to go, but it didn't get picked up. You know what I mean? He did not make it into the other media. I mean, you know that he loves being in Woody Allen's movie and wanted to get involved with movies even more. He was available. Just that the stigma of just being an old professor, that rearview mirror image of him prevented people taking advantage of him. He could have made better Broadway, better movies maybe, yeah, than whatever was happening.
Possibly. Anyway, should we keep pressing on?
Okay, well, we seem to have hit... Andrew has brought us into a difficult, maybe tedious theme, but it's important to be said what we're saying.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Okay, so maybe what we're trying to talk about is trying to articulate the changes in McLuhan.
Right, and how much in the Gutenberg, you know, how much was formulaic, how much was... What was he a vorticist from 1945 to 1980, or was he not? You know, was he Western? Was he cross-cultural? All those points, Marshall, there's evidence of different angles on it.
And so many of McLuhan's critics, they trot out this some conventional mythology. McLuhan was a moralist up until 1951. With the Mechanical Bride, he discovered Innes. He got turned on to communication. Blah, 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 blah. He hit the 70s and became quite dark on it all.
That's wrong.
So wrong.
And someone like Scott Taylor can give us evidence. I mean, you got McLuhan doing yoga in the 70s. Is that Gnostic? He writes, he categorizes yoga as part of the horizontal symbolism school, the Manichaean secret society of the 40s and 50s. The point is the world has really changed, and being a Catholic is not that important in the 70s.
Well, can you be a Gnostic in the 20th century?
Yeah, you can be in the 70s, you can be a Gnostic. That's so rearview mirror. So the you know, he on Wednesdays he was a devout Catholic, but on Saturday and Monday he was probing the new trying to be an anti-environment to the android meme. You know, that's there's the part of this. He is not a lonely, dark, abandoned conservative in the 70s. He's right there coming up with great new patterns about what was actually happening. And so that's what people miss. And I'm saying that showed his capacity to change and learn, which is really the humanist ideal. So he was a humanist in that sense. But it was with post-humanist environments.
Yeah, in a certain sense, you could sort of say that McLuhan was the proto-goth in the late 70s. Like the whole gothic pop culture like kicks off like early 80s, and McLuhan's moving into that phase.
And he's a proto-punk. There's a book by an English professor in Dalhousie, Nova Scotia. It didn't get anywhere, but he talked about the violence in the arts of the 60s. And that violence that came in was sparked by McLuhan. So he saw McLuhan as an intellectual thug and a punk. You know, and that's what I have in my chart. You can look at my tiny note chart as a portrait of McLuhan. It's a portrait of the android meme, but he was miming the android meme. So Marshall put on all those various poses. The beatnik, remember we quoted last week, 2 weeks ago, the beatnik professor in the 50s. Then he's the hippie professor. Then he's the, what would he be, the yuppie professor? By then, you know, he didn't make it to be called a yuppie professor. He was a yuppie. He's the only one analyzing the streakers, you know, in 74, 75. He's the only one who could make patterns. He continued making relevant patterns about passing fads. Which fads were figures for ground changes? Just the ground was changing faster. So fast by the mid-70s that a couple of aphorisms or delineations by McLuhan was all you needed. Didn't need a whole book on it. He was getting streamlined. Fast and bulbous and tight and tapered.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I made this statement somewhere over the past couple of weeks that he was I think I was saying it to Scott Taylor in a private conversation. He was the Leonardo da Vinci of the software world of pattern recognition. The Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci makes hardware inventions. Is the archetypal sets the ground rules for new mechanical inventions. But McLuhan was setting the ground rules for software invention, which would be pattern recognition.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so sound like we're making a little progress now. So he says, so here is Andrew quoting more about the forward to the interior landscape. Marshall writes, now he's quoting Marshall now, not McNamara. Marshall says, Cambridge was a shock. Richards, Leavis, Elliot, and Pound and Joyce in a few weeks opened the doors of perception on the poetic process and its role in adjusting the reader to the contemporary world. My study of media began and is rooted in the work of these men. Well, I say in the 70s, Marshall wasn't studying media anymore. He was in the ring with it. There was no time to do a study of the media. He was applying the tools and tuned into the super angelizing environment. See, this definitely is, what this statement is about the art forms of McLuhan in the Gutenberg Galaxy. His books.
Yep.
But that ends in the 70s. You see what I'm saying? He's writing what was relevant to his discoveries and applications of new criticism to the book world and the media world in the 1560s. And so we're actually making a new mandate here. There was something new going on with McLuhan in the 70s that no one's even registered. And it's so appropriate that we're doing this after the MUM conference with Scott Taylor, because he is the Boswell, the witness of that new level. And he's the one who actually turned McLuhan on into brain research.
Yeah, well, the conventional mythology that is, I guess, propped up in everything that was pretty much written in the 1970s is McLuhan's health was in decline. He had turned to more an apocalyptic output. He wasn't producing anything new. It's only his collaborators that were producing things. But essentially, isn't the problem is talking about the thing that cannot be talked about? Like his praxis, whether he's an artist, educator, scientist, politician, all these things at once, has started to slip off what am I trying to say?
He's gone into the black hole.
Yeah. It's off the register of what the written word can actually say. Hey, this guy's criticizing this, or this guy's doing this. He's starting to blur.
Yeah, you look at the articles in the 70s. They're skimpy. They have good patterns, but they're not literature. He can explain Monty Python. He can explain the Roots TV series. He explains what's happening in the mixed corporate media of the global theater with great patterns. And it's just a sentence or two and a few jokes. Those are his talks. I mean, nothing like the writing in the 50s and 40s. So it's because it was the performance of speech dealing with the new environments that he did a lot of in the 70s, going around talking all over the place. That was the art form, the casual, cool way of pointing to stuff with very little words.
Yeah, it's almost like he wrote with the knowledge that that sooner or later somebody would be reading everything that he wrote. So he wrote with that, or and engaged with that confidence that everything was, although I loathe to use the word intertextual, is resonating with everything else that he's done throughout his whole history, his whole life.
And that's proven in the letters. He knows the role of the letter. Somebody once asked him, why are your newspaper editorials so easy to understand? He says, because the newspaper is expository. So he would spell out what he was doing in his newspaper letters to the editor, and people would get great insights. The same for his letters. Now, people didn't have access to his letters till after he died and then the publication of it. But many people have a great increased understanding of McLuhan by reading the letters because it's an expository medium. Now, the explaining of himself is not relevant when you're in a black hole. But he did organize the content of his explanation for the literate galaxy. And it was orchestrated. And you're right. It was all depositive. You'd find he'd repeat the themes in his articles in the 60s, and there'd be one new statement about some new phenomenon that would be relevant. That would be really good. But you'd have to wade through the familiar repeated stuff of articles written over 6 months. And then you'd find him commenting on Tim Lear and LSD, totally relevant to 1967. He knew that if you read all his work, you'd find the jewels, find one jewel in every article.
And I guess a part of that is also if he's writing for the computer satellite situation, audiences are already starting to fragment. So your work has got to take on a different quality.
That's right. You don't even do that kind of work anymore. He didn't to be the 60s public intellectual. He even says he's one of the few people who explained that the youth counterculture around San Francisco and the hippie counterculture was fragmented by FM radio. And so even he as a figure of the counterculture, which some think he still today was, he had moved on in the late 60s, early 70s to not trying to preserve that counterculture. I mean, he was dealing with the fact that instant replay wiped out everything for human metaphysics.
That's a great point. And like what I don't get is why people don't see that the tetrads is it's obsolete. When he's playing it out in the 70s, it's obsolete. It's an obsolete dichotomy. He's talking about these forms after he's already announced that forms don't exist anymore.
Right. He's in the pentadic. He's cyborging. He knows the machines are better analysts of the scene than he can be. And so he plays with the tetrad. He says, I got to use tetrads when I talk to you. Not words. I got to use tetrads to look like I'm human.
Yeah, they would have been great in the 60s when they're still forms, but now I'm going to use this stuff. You might recognize it. And when you start doing them, you'll start seeing that they don't work. Yeah, Scott Taylor did the last tetrad, I think, on virtual reality. I think it's the last tetrad that you can possibly do.
Yeah, the one that's available in his historical writings, you're saying it's I've read that. It's a fantastic tetrad, right?
it's the ultimate tetrad before they totally show
the pentad. He's intuiting the pentad. About this, there's something about he actually. You have Andy Warhol running a magazine and hanging out with the Jet Set and then creating Studio 77. And he's going, is it 57? 77, whatever it is. Studio 54. He's being a non-entity. He's going to become considered the greatest artist in American New York culture. And he's doing nothing. Well, McLuhan was doing as much nothing as Warhol. And there was this journalist in New York City back in late 90s, early 2000s. No, yeah, it was 2002 or so. Alan Cabal, he wrote an article and he begins by saying, Marshall McLuhan was the Andy Warhol of big science. And I thought that was incredible. And so I made a point of meeting him and he got intrigued at what I told him. And so he did an article on me for the New York Press, but the editor suppressed it. But the point is, we had a comment, this statement, the Andy Warhol of big science. Now, that's Andy Warhol. He wants to be a machine. He's a bland nothing. There's that quality in McLuhan. The bland nothing is the anti-environment. He's not tired. He's not any of these things. He's purposely being the bland guy, even faking it by claiming he's having strokes all the time.
Yeah, okay. No, there's something cool about that. I've got a letter right here in front of me now that McLuhan writing to Edward T. Hall. Reading Heisenberg has made me feel that my media studies are at the state that nuclear studies had reached in 1924. But my heart sinks because those nuclear studies were being urged forward by eager teams and media studies enjoys no such support at all. But I am bold to say that many of the same techniques and concepts are needed for advancing media studies as were used for nuclear studies. But there is a huge difference that media studies involves human lives far more profoundly than nuclear studies ever have done or ever can do. So,
did you say human life involve human life?
Media studies involves... involve human lives far more profoundly than nuclear studies ever have done or ever can do.
That's right. We have on Dave Neufeld's album, the second Meetings and Massage album, McLuhan saying, in maybe it's in class, that the TV is way more devastating than the atomic bomb.
Yeah, so, yeah. But like, it's definitely... gives a little bit of weight also to this comment that if McLuhan was the Warhol of big science, I mean, I don't think a lot of people realize the degree to which McLuhan had an eye to physics.
Had what?
Had an eye on physics.
Oh, yeah, on big science. I don't know how Cabell, I don't know how much McLuhan read, but it's just a clever statement, but it was true. Yeah, big science was who he was taking on. And the establishment in all the major. He was taking on Western civilization. I remember, who was it? Walter Boert once said to me, after talking to me through the 80s, he called me up in a panic, and he said, I was re-looking at laws of media. He says, McLuhan's trying to wipe out Western civilization. It's like he was in a conservative mood, Boert, like he wanted to preserve Western. He thought McLuhan was like radical terrorist, you know? But that's true. That's an accurate perception of the depth of McLuhan. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, or possibly, you could equally go the other way and say McLuhan's vision was so apocalyptic that he saw that laws of media was the most that you could hope to preserve.
Right. Now, you're blipping out a bit. Did you move your relationship to your microphone there?
Yeah, sorry, I moved forward. Becoming too engaged, Bob. Involved.
Yeah. It's still stand back even more.
Yeah.
It's still okay. So he was not trying to destroy Western civilization, but what Boert was picking up is that McLuhan was pointing out how Western civilization had completely disappeared. So again, Boert was blaming McLuhan for causing the fire, and all McLuhan did was set in the barometer information or the fire alarm.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Even as the critics didn't see just quite how far he'd gone, how apocalyptic in a sense of that he was.
Right. Now, you got a problem there with your mic. How can we fix this? Can you move the mic or move your position?
I'll adopt an optimistic outlook.
Yeah, right there, where you are now, it's clear.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
I'm feeling much better.
Beg your pardon?
I'm feeling much better.
Yeah, like, so, this is good that we're emphasizing. This is important to understand that the appraisal of McLuhan in the 70s is ridiculous. They have no clue. It's because he's gone. But Croker is close. He says Marshall had gone over into the simulacrum. Now, I think that's Croker talking about McLuhan's 60s. Well, he went even further than that in the 70s. He actually maybe even reappeared. And Scott Taylor, again, the synchronicity of this, we urge our listeners to listen to the 4.5 hours discussing Scott's work. Scott would totally understand what we're saying. And he told me when I first met him a couple of years ago that people don't realize what went on in the 70s. That there's a whole range of McLuhan expression and purpose that nobody's ever registered. And the only one who was a witness to that, an articulate witness, is Scott Taylor.
He is, particularly after hearing him today, I would say he is the among the best people in terms of picking up where McLuhan was at in the '70s and running with it.
Yeah, he's the best bridge to Dobbstown.
Yes.
Yeah. So he would agree with what we're saying. And we can repeat these themes when he's with us next. Remember what we're saying here. McLuhan was the Andy Warhol of not only big science, but of being a human being.
I guess maybe to contextualize it in terms of...
He was the Andy Warhol of Roman Catholicism. How's that one?
Don't know about that one, Bob.
Yeah, I know. It's too close to home for your chemical body, right?
Well, no, I'm not sure that it's accurate. I think it has got value as a probe, but I'll weigh it up. I'll think about it. I'll get back to you.
You're blipping out again. We caused a little earthquake again. If you can get back in the balanced position. But what were you going to say? I think you were going to say something else.
Where did I blip out?
Say it again.
The witch.
You broke up again.
When?
Just now, that sentence.
Ah. Okay, so...
Let me go forward. Let me talk.
Yep.
And so we have... we just quoted McLuhan's foreword. Now, what is the relevance of this in Andrew McLuhan's column here? He's pointing out... He's again dealing with the... pop image of McLuhan and trying to retrieve Marshall as the literary writer, which might be part of Eric's agenda or what Andrew's picked up, that Marshall is a fine, upstanding preserver of the 19th century. I mean, why is he quoting these points? He says, without further digression, here's what's written inside the front cover of Marshall's copy of, quote, Some Versions of Pastoral by William Empson. A book came out in 1935,